though we've seemed to move temporarily beyond the teachings of streams and mountains, let's keep this thread alive. The teaching of the insentient. Remember that Sudong Po awoke to the way upon hearing the valley stream, after hearing the teaching of the insentient beings expounding Dharma. Oh, some of you were here when we talked about Dongshan. And this story that he recounted and his trying to understand sentient beings, non-sentient beings speaking Dharma. So Dogen's essay called Non-Sentient Beings Speaking Dharma presents the story of Dongshan. This version, this somewhat abbreviated version, recounts that Dongshan asked Yunyan, "Who can hear insentient beings speak Dharma?" And Yunyan said, "Insentient beings hear insentient beings speak Dharma." Dongshan said, "Do you hear it?" Yunyan said, "If I heard it, you could not hear me speak Dharma." And Dongshan said, "Being so, I don't hear you speak Dharma." And Yunyan said, "You haven't been hearing me speak Dharma, so how could you hear insentient beings speak Dharma?" So that's a little part of that, this intricate story about non-sentient beings teaching Dharma incessantly and radiantly, according to the sutras, and who hears this teaching of the non-sentient beings. Here, Yunyan says non-sentient beings hear that teaching. In a previous conversation, Dongshan heard that the saints hear the teaching of the non-sentient. And then Dongshan asked that teacher, "Do you hear it, teacher?" And he said, "No, if I heard it, I would be a saint and you wouldn't hear my teaching." So one version is that these holy ones, these saints, hear Dharma, and one is that non-sentient beings hear Dharma. And technically speaking, it comes to mind now, so saints is this term Arya. The noble ones, the Aryans in the Mahayana, are those who have realized emptiness in a direct way, and they call this the change of lineage when you become a noble one, because the lineage that you were part of for countless eons before was the lineage of sentient beings, and now you've entered the lineage of, we could say, non-sentient beings, like the lineage to Buddhahood. So on the Bodhisattva path like this, are these various great Bodhisattvas really not sentient beings? A Buddha is often contrasted with sentient beings. So a Buddha is not a sentient being, but are these bodhisattvas, these noble, holy bodhisattvas, not sentient beings? Well, they seem to be in the lineage of non-sentient beings, even if there's some sentience left. And then we have these other non-sentient beings like rocks and tiles and pebbles. So is there some relationship between, like, Buddhas, the Buddha's non-sentient, and a rock's non-sentience? This is many different things could be said about that relationship. So here in the Dogen's comments on Dungshan saying, I don't hear you speak Dharma. When Dungshan says, do you hear it? And Yunnan said, if I heard it, you could not hear me speak Dharma. And Dungshan says, I don't hear you speak Dharma. And when, so Dogen's comments on, I don't hear you speak Dharma. I don't hear you speak Dharma. At this moment, Dungshan not only became part of the audience, but also revealed his towering determination to speak Dharma for insentient beings. Yeah, I don't know if this means the audience that hears non-sentient beings. But he also revealed his determination to speak Dharma for insentient beings by saying, I don't hear you speak Dharma. Actually, hearing Dharma is not limited to ear sense and ear consciousness. You hear Dharma with complete power, complete mind, complete body, and complete way from before your parents were born, before the empty eon, through the entire future, the unlimited future. You can hear Dharma with body first and mind last. So this is some thoughts of Dogen on how hearing Dharma, and I think he's particularly referring to the Dharma of non-sentient beings. But maybe all Dharma from sentient and non-sentient beings is not limited to the ear sense faculty and the ear consciousness. It's not limited to that, but means sometimes it could come through the ear, but it's not limited to that. You hear Dharma with complete power, complete mind, complete body, and complete way from before your parents were born. You hear the Dharma with the complete way before your parents were born. Such ways of hearing the Dharma are all effective. Don't think that you're not benefited by hearing the Dharma if it does not reach your mind consciousness. So, you might be listening to this right now and feel like this Dharma that we're hearing from Dogen here is not reaching my mind consciousness. In other words, I can't make heads or tails of it. It's not reaching my mind in the form of what I think of as Dharma, which means like teachings to help us wake up. I don't think this is helping me at all. It's kind of like gibberish. But don't think that you're not benefited by hearing the Dharma if it does not reach your mind consciousness. A facing mind, dropping body, you hear the Dharma and see the result. With no mind and no body, you should hear Dharma and benefit from it. Experiencing such moments is how all Buddha ancestors become Buddhas and attain ancestorhood. Ordinary people cannot understand that Dharma power transforms body and mind. The boundary of body and mind cannot be encompassed. When the effect of hearing Dharma is planted in the field of body and mind, it never decays. It's bound to grow and bear fruit. Could the field of body and mind be the storehouse? Field, this, the ground in which everything that we're experiencing is planted. When the effect of hearing Dharma is planted in that field, the body and mind, it never decays. It's bound to grow and bear fruit. So Dharma seeds may be being planted when we don't even know they're Dharma seeds and we don't know what fruit will result. And in fact, we have this story in the mind-only tradition of how does this is one story from the great teacher Asanga, the founder of that tradition, said in talking about the storehouse consciousness, he said, well, it's just storing all these dualistic appearances, it's storing all these confused, distorted experiences that understand mind and object dualistically. It's just, that's all that's in it, really. I mean, in this case, he's not really talking about the Tathagatagarbha. So, that's a little piece that we could see related to this. He's saying, well, how can this storehouse of delusions ever realize Buddha wisdom and be transformed into Buddhahood, or be dissolved and reveal the Buddhahood? How can any like non-dual wisdom enter such a dualistic storehouse consciousness? And he says, it's a seed, just like everything that's planted in Alaya is a seed. But it's a seed of pure wisdom coming from the Dharmakaya. I think he says it like that. A seed, a pure, perfect wisdom seed is planted in Alaya. It doesn't come from us. It comes from the Dharmakaya through hearing. That's how this little virus gets planted in Alaya and kind of like unravels the whole thing. There's this one little seed. And how does the seed get in there? We could say the Dharmakaya, we're talking this morning about the Dharmakaya responding to beings. So this might be one way to talk about the Dharmakaya responding to beings, is it comes in the form of a seed planted, but not like a god-like being that just kind of zaps us with this perfect wisdom seed. The Dharmakaya seed comes to us through hearing. And that hearing may be the hearing of the non-sentient beings teaching Dharma. Yes?
Is that bodhicitta?
Bodhicitta arises in the relationship between, we could say, that the Dharmakaya and the sentient being. And that relationship, in this case, is the form of hearing. So yeah, that makes a nice connection to bodhicitta, which is coming soon in our essay at hand. Yeah, bodhicitta, according to Dogen, this is a kind of unique Dogen take. Bodhicitta isn't caused by ourself and isn't caused by the Buddhas. It's caused in that relationship. So, you know, we could say that perfect wisdom seed coming from the Dharmakaya through hearing is our relationship to the Buddha.
Yeah, yeah, that was kind of, well, this morning when Nanette was struggling with the seeming kind of deism,
yeah,
the Dharmakaya, I was trying to say what I'm going to say now, which is my experience of that. It is more the bodhicitta thing, you know, that Dharmakaya isn't outside of us, but it isn't, you know, it's like potential. And when we recognize Buddha nature, and when we recognize the Dharma, when we experience that, you know, in the plum blossom or in whatever, then that's how we access Dharmakaya, is through our bodhicitta. That's how I'm thinking about it.
We access Dharmakaya through our bodhicitta. Yeah, I think.
I mean, it's the resonance.
I can say that.
There's something in us that recognizes it. It's always there.
Yeah.
It's always. It doesn't come and go.
And it's true. It's not outside us. We could also say it's not really within us either, because it's unlocatable. But it's very intimate with us, actually. It's, of course, not a thing, the Dharmakaya. But what we call the Dharmakaya is this... well, it's also said to be compassionate, which is kind of maybe troublesome too, because that makes it more like a being then. But it's the compassionate, empty nature of Buddha that's accessible to us all the time, but we're usually not accessing it so clearly. And the way we access it, according to Asanga in that story, is through hearing. And I think he's referring to hearing, particularly these Dharma teachings about how the Dharmakaya works. Of course, hearing just words isn't actually it, because the meaning is not in the words. That's why the Buddha's taught in words sometimes, so we can hear them. But also, non-sentient beings teach Dharma not in words. And so could those non-sentient beings be aspects of Dharmakaya, manifestations of Dharmakaya? Yes.
The word potential, when speaking about seeds of Dharmakaya or seeds of bodhicitta, could the word potential also kind of be synonymous with inevitable?
And sometimes Buddha nature or Tathagata Garbha is spoken of as a potential also, which some people actually don't prefer to talk about it that way, because they feel like it's not, there's something, if it's potential that's not fully complete and has to come to completion, then that's the problem with saying potential. But if we say potential is inevitability, that shifts a little bit into it's inevitably the case already, and it's inevitably the case that it will be fully manifested eventually. So yeah, we can play with the word inevitable in this context.
And I guess the word inevitable came up for me because I can't find mine. But I remember there's that question, you know, who has the causes and conditions, and then someone responds who doesn't have the causes and conditions.
Well, it's more like who enters the way. Who doesn't enter the way through causes and conditions, or who doesn't realize, who could realize apart from causes and conditions?
And I think ripe was the word actually.
Yeah, ripe in conditions.
Why do you end this with ripened causes will never go away?
And then Dogen says after that,
who does not enter with ripened causes, who enters and then goes away.
Yeah.
This awakening is not limited to a mean one.
And so what about that?
Sorry, I can't see the light that's blocking me. So I was reading that as you know, it would help if I could read it.
Who could enter the way? I think the gist of it is who could enter the way apart from causes and conditions. In other words, it's inevitable that one enters the way through causes and through conditionality.
That it's inevitable that there are seeds in there too, even if we don't, you know, we're not aware of them.
Like the wisdom seeds?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so again, in this text by Asanga, he where he says, in this whole text that I'm referring to, Tathagatagarbha and Buddha nature never come up. It's like, that's not, at that time, that was not even an issue. But instead of that, he says, how does this happen? It's this pure wisdom seed from the purest reality realm and Dharmakaya that comes through hearing. And so, when I heard that, I thought, like, that sounds like a kind of a primitive version or a different version of Buddha nature. Like it's a Buddha nature seed. Mm-hmm. So, so from the Buddha nature teaching perspective, it's like, yeah, it's inevitable that there's Buddha nature seeds. Now, do we talk about them as seeds? Usually they wouldn't talk about them as, usually the seeds are more like karmic seeds, but something like that. They're like mixed in. If the seeds are like little particles of sediment, of karmic experiences, then the Buddha nature, maybe we could say Buddha nature molecules of pure water mixed in with the particulate matter. And that's already and always the case, inevitably the case. So, instead of saying it has to come from hearing through the Dharmakaya, the Buddha nature story makes it even easier in a way. It says it doesn't even have to come through hearing through the Dharmakaya. We already have it. But maybe we could say our way of accessing it has to come through hearing. And again, this hearing may not be words of sutras and commentaries, but may be hearing of the non-sentient. Yes?
So many people talk about this practice, including myself, the kind of awareness that we develop of our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's, you know, just trying out this yoga posture for the first time in our lives and then cultivating it, or whether it's sort of an energy field that we feel in sesshin, or even on a Wednesday night, sitting with so many people. I'm just thinking that's another way that I've experienced
Dharma. Is we hear the Dharma of the body.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of what Dogen's saying here too, right? That when he says you can hear Dharma with body first and mind last. So the field. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then, how does that accord with this mind?
Oh, no. I was hoping no one would ask.
I'm dope. You know, I'm not convinced of, and I don't mean to put us back on that track, but that was such a strong articulation of my resonance with that is the thing that keeps me from being able to rest in mind only. And I'm just curious, how do you take that?
Dogen has that other essay called Body and Mind Study of the Way, where he has the first half, he talks about entering the way through the body, like turning somersaults and things like that. And then the second half is about entering the way through mind. And then I think he talks about entering the way through body, mind, that there's no difference really, and dropped off body and mind. So we could say from the classical mind-only perspective, the body is mind, actually. The body is a manifestation of mind from that teaching, but let's enter through that particular manifestation of mind called the body. That'd be kind of maybe a traditional way to say it. But we could also refer to the body only school, which is not so traditional.
Is there one?
Now there is. we can create it with our mind. The body only school. So it's like there's no mind, particularly a mind, you know, a conceptual mind. That all that is just, all conceptual minds are just illusion. But there's the body only. You could even say it's the Dharma body. When it's fully realized, it's the Dharma body. The Buddha has three bodies. And no mind. So we can say it in different ways. But if we're entering the way through body, I would say that it's important to remember that it's not our idea of the body and our limited idea of, like, the skin bag itself, right? That's a very limited, constructed body. But if we talk about it like as some field or collective body, some sense other than a conceptual mind sense, we could call that body. So mind only doesn't discount the body. It just says that there's totally an experience of body, but it comes, it arises from mind. But to study the way with body could be like, we know that it's an emanation of mind, but we're really gonna like enter through this particular emanation of mind called the body. That'd be another way to put it. Instead of saying, well, it's almost like we're forgetting our body and just getting caught up in some ethereal mind stuff. Mind only doesn't need to be like that. If you mind only, it could be realized through the arising manifestation called this body.
Well, I think that's why Dogen says body mind. I think he's helping us here. I think he's helping us not to get caught in separating.
Mm-hmm.
He's calling it body mind, one word.
And body mind dropped off.
Yeah.
So it's like everything we think of both mind and body, all of that is dropped off. And then, is there another body, a true body and true mind? No body, no mind. And for sure, Dogen, when he gets into all his mind stuff too, is always emphasizing the basic practice in Zazen and outside of Zazen is to be in this body, this particular body posture that we're in. So like the Fugan Zazengi we chanted this morning, most of it is about the body. This is how you practice Zazen. You arrange the body in this particular way, breathe in this particular way, rock the body in this particular way, put the body's tongue on the roof of the body's mouth, and then settle into a steady, immovable, physical, bodily sitting position, and then think of not thinking. Non-thinking. So it's body and mind practice. But if we start to, if we lose our grounding in body, then we won't be able to open to mind teachings, I don't think. So, Yogacara is another almost like a synonym for mind only, as far as the name of the school. Maybe there's a little distinction sometimes, but often they're even equated, the Yogacara school or the mind only school. Yoga and Yogacara means like yoga practice. and that would be mind and body, but particularly yogic practices of include body and mind. And Yogacara emphasizes a lot of like practical bodily speech practices, like the paramitas, and many bodhisattva practices, and bodhisattva precepts and conduct are all really emphasized in Yogacara, compared to, say, Madhyamaka, is really emphasizing emptiness. Of course, Nagarjuna has a lot of actually other writings on bodhisattva conduct also, but Yogacara, it's a body-mind school, but particularly for the understanding of the reality is emphasized is mind only. But let's keep exploring about how body fits into mind only. Yes.
When you said body only, mm-hmm. I know that you didn't mean it that way, but it made me think about neurobiologists that they exist that try to explain what the soul is or what how the mind functions by looking at cells under a microscope and measuring potentials. It's actually, in that moment I was kind of astounded by how limited that is.
Yeah.
Because they can never step out, it's have too much grasping onto what they think is reality.
It's all about, it's like the materialist school. Yeah, I mean, we could have one version of body only that would be like pure materialism. And sometimes mind only is called pure idealism. And then so that would be like an extreme dichotomy, so maybe it's not really so separate. It's a body-mind only. How about the dropped-off body and mind only school? That's our school. But that brings up an interesting thing that let's save it for this the mind only class. But one of the issues that if we say when we really start to doubt that everything's mind only, one of the problems for any other view than mind only is what's the relation, how is mind, we're not talking about a brain now, we're talking about awareness itself, consciousness is not a physical thing. How is this awareness going to contact the material world? And not just all schools of Buddhism from the earliest days had this issue. When we really start looking at like how does a sense consciousness meet a material object, and they came up with all kinds of very complicated and wacky theories to explain how these two are going to meet. How it's basically mind and matter. How mind and matter are going to meet. It's a problem. And the nice thing about Yogacara, mind only, of all the schools of Buddhism, it's the only one that that actually resolves that issue. And it's resolved by saying that there isn't matter. Right? All the other four schools say that there is matter, and so they come up with things like, well, matter, the physical world produces what they call an akara, like an aspect, which is kind of a semi-mental thing, and that's what contacts the sense consciousness. They get very complicated, but then still, how does the physical object produce this mental aspect, very, very subtle mental overlay that's the color produces this kind of like image. Sometimes it's called an image, and then the image is seen by the eye organ as a color. But if that image is a mental thing, not a physical thing, how does the physical thing produce that image? At some point you're going to have that split. You can divide it, you can look for it wherever you want, but it's going to be a problem. Yeah.
Buddha was once asked by a monk if how the world was created, and the monk had quite a number of questions, and the Buddha basically said it, I never told you I would have these answers. And it's irrelevant for your practice. So I was wondering if the Buddha was here right now, what do you think about this discussion?
Yeah, there's the 10 unanswerable questions. And they often have to do with origins of universe and the self, and like we were talking about, where, you know, if everything's originally pure, where does the first delusion come from? Things like that we can't ever know. But there are some of these intricate issues that do seem to be important to practitioners to clarify what's true and what's not true. And this, actually, in order to let go of grasping false views, sometimes Dharma gets kind of complicated. But we could discuss, we could question whether some of these Dharma teachings get too complicated. Especially, like, out of context, you know. Like, we can maybe build up to the super complicated when we're really grounded in the basic. But it seems like there's a lot of practitioners who feel like it's really important to clarify the subtlety of the view of what's true and what's not. So, yeah, we can ask what's a useless question and what's not as this discussion goes on. Dogen continues talking about non-sentient beings teaching Dharma. Ordinary people cannot understand that Dharma power transforms body and mind. The boundary of body and mind cannot be encompassed. When the effect of hearing Dharma is planted in the field of body and mind, it never decays. It's bound to grow and bear fruit. Foolish people may think that when we hear Dharma, if we do not advance in understanding and cannot remember the teaching, there will be no benefit from it. They say, if we don't feel like it's helping us and our understanding, and we don't even remember it, that there's no benefit. He's saying that's not true, actually. Those foolish people think that forgetting the teaching, absent-mindedly leaving the place of instruction, creates no benefit and no accomplishment. Some people might absent-mindedly leave this place of instruction and kind of wander in and out sometimes. But foolish people say that creates no benefit or accomplishment. Let's leave it at that for now. That what we think is Dharma that we're learning, you know, things that make sense to our mind, consciousness, and all, is the Dharma of the sentient. And like I can say it, and Dogen can say it, and you can hear it, but there may also be this non-sentient being Dharma, the kind that, like, we don't quite hear, like, we're not even paying attention and we've forgotten everything. That could be the Dharma of non-sentient beings, is like when we're like half asleep, listening to words that aren't reaching our understanding, consciousness. Maybe that would be another kind of non-sentient beings teaching the Dharma, and non-sentient beings hearing it. It's interesting to me that Dogen points out in this case, don't say that that's useless. You never know what's useful or not. So now, Dogen continues with his admonitions. So these people seeking fame and profit, and practicing Dharma, practicing the way for fame and profit, beginning of page 3, Rujing, my late master, old Buddha, called such people pitiful fellows. because of unwholesome causes in previous lives, they do not seek Dharma for the sake of Dharma. In this life, they are suspicious of the true dragon when they see it and are put off by genuine Dharma when they meet it. As their body, mind, flesh, and bones are not ready to follow Dharma, or is this word again, to accord with or comply with Dharma, they are unable to receive it. And it's actually to receive and employ it. The ju-yu, right? Ji-ju-yu means the self-receiving and employing samadhi. So, and when you heard this before, some of you I know, when you combine receive and employ, in Chinese as a compound, it means to enjoy, either to fulfill or enjoy. So it's a dynamic character. Sometimes we translate it as self-receiving and employing samadhi, or self-fulfilling samadhi, or self-enjoyment samadhi, or the self-receiving its function. So the self is not in here now, but receiving and employing is here. So the people seeking fame and profit are unable to receive and employ the Dharma, or are unable to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. They're unable to enjoy it and fulfill it. Because the lineage of the ancestral school started a long time ago, the aspiration for enlightenment has become a distant dream. So now I'm going to get into a section on aspiration for enlightenment, in this case, Bodhi Shin, the way of saying Bodhi Chitta, Bodhi Mind, Bodhi Heart, Shin. How pitiful that people do not know about or see treasure, even though they were born on a mountain of treasure. Where can they find Dharma treasure? As soon as you arouse the aspiration for enlightenment, bodhicitta, even if you transmigrate in the six realms and four forms of birth, transmigration itself will be your vow for enlightenment, for bodhi. Transmigration itself will be your cause and condition of the practice and vows of enlightenment. Or transmigration in birth and death and samsara will be the conditions of your practice and vows. Once you make this, once you arouse bodhicitta. So Thomas Cleary's translation is very nice here, I think. After having aroused the aspiration for enlightenment, even if one migrates through various ways of life, the conditions of that migration all become practical undertakings of enlightenment. That's even more straightforward, right? So it's kind of like once you arouse this aspiration, then your mundane life in the world, in these birth and death, the conditions of your life all become the practical undertakings of enlightenment. That's a great statement in this fascicle, I think. Once we have this aspiration, I want to practice for the benefit of all beings and realize the way, and we're keeping that intention alive, then all this troublesome, mundane activity of daily life becomes the conditions for our awakening. That's a really important point. So in the six realms, I think you know the hell realms, the hungry ghost realms, and animal realms, human realm, the god realm, and then there's jealous godlike beings who want to be gods. The god wannabes, maybe we could call it. The six realms are what, you know, birth and death, samsaric transmigration, and the four forms of birth. This is just the old Buddhist way of talking, you know, being born from a womb, from an egg, from moisture like mosquitoes, and spontaneously born. It's kind of like old Indian science. The biologists would say, what do you mean four forms of birth? What, it was moisture? Are mosquitoes really born from moisture? I don't think so. But that's how they saw it in the old days. And we, you know, we're born in these different ways over and over again, in these six realms, four forms of birth, called samsara. Now, here's Dogen talking about bodhicitta. And it's very, in this case, he's very traditional, at least to begin with here. He's just, with the way he defines bodhicitta, arousing the aspiration for enlightenment. Hotsu bodhayashin. Hotsu is giving rise to, or arousing bodhicitta. Is making a vow to bring all sentient beings to the shore of enlightenment before you bring yourself. And, that's one part, and actualizing the vow. So making the vow and then actualizing the vow. Even a humble person who arouses this aspiration is already a guiding teacher of all sentient beings. Aspiration for enlightenment, or another two aspects, is said to be the wish to realize complete enlightenment, complete Buddhahood, in order to benefit all beings. And in this case, traditionally, it's not always said that, you know, all others first, but that is one of the types, and that's the one Dogen's emphasizing. But bringing all beings to the other shore is like, you know, helping them become complete Buddhas before we're a complete Buddha. And how exactly that could work is maybe kind of mysterious. Because how do we, if we don't even know how to become a Buddha, how can we help others become a Buddha? But this is the kind that Dogen likes to emphasize. It's almost like it's like giving up the trying to figure out how we're gonna do it. We just really want all beings to not just be like kind of happy, but complete Buddhas. And the way we've been talking about Buddhahood, like to realize the Dharmakaya, right? To drop off the sentient being completely. We wish that for everyone before ourself. And now here's the what Kathy was asking about. Think about how does this, is it like bodhicitta come when we meet the Dharmakaya? Something like that. So Dogen's way of talking about it is this aspiration is neither originally existent nor does it emerge all of a sudden. You know, it's not like the aspiration was always here, but it's not like it suddenly appears like it wasn't here and now it is here. It's neither one of those. And it's neither one nor many. It's neither spontaneous nor gradual. It's not in yourself, nor are you in it. This aspiration is not pervasive in this world of phenomena. It's neither before nor after. It's neither existent nor non-existent. It's neither self-nature nor other nature. And so on. So it's pretty ungraspable, this bodhicitta aspiration. Yet, so all these things that it's not, right? Yet, in response to affinity, now here in this translation, cause, or someone's put in parentheses between teacher and student, but I think more traditionally, it's between sentient beings and Buddhas, that affinity. It's this term kanodoko, the the mysterious resonance, the mystical communion, spiritual communion, kano, doko, the inquiry and response path of crossing, could roughly translate it like that. Mystical communion. In response to affinity, the aspiration arises. It's not given by Buddhas or Bodhisattvas. It doesn't just come from the Dharmakaya, and it's not created by yourself. The aspiration arises in response to affinity, or response to affinity is another way of saying, in this mystical communion between Buddhas and yourself. Thus, it's not spontaneous. And this aspiration for enlightenment has been aroused mostly by humans who live in the southern continent of Jambudvipa, called this world.
Where is this
state reading from? Hotsu Bodaishin, Arousing the Aspiration for Enlightenment, the 70th chapter of the Shobogenzo. There's two, I think, in a row. Hotsu Bodaishin and Hotsu Mujoshin. Yeah, arousing the aspiration for the unsurpassable. So there's two in a row, and they say one was maybe a written talk, a written essay, and one was maybe an oral teaching. Or some people say one was for lay people and one was for the monastics. And there's different stuff in each. But this is the one that particularly mentions this. It arises in this mystical communion between. It doesn't say, well, it kind of does say, because it says it's not given by Buddhas or Bodhisattvas, and it's not created by yourself. It arises in the response to affinity, or it responds to the inquiring impulse. After arousing this aspiration for enlightenment, then Bodhisattvas practice for many eons. It's a big project. Again, he says, the meaning of the aspiration for enlightenment, bodhicitta, is to endeavor without ceasing, in body, speech, and mind, to help all sentient beings to arouse the aspiration for enlightenment. Kind of funny, huh? The aspiration for enlightenment is to endeavor to help all sentient beings arouse the aspiration for enlightenment. Instead of saying it's to just, like, enlighten them, it's to get everyone to arouse the aspiration. This leads them into the Buddha way. To provide sentient beings merely with worldly pleasure is not beneficial to them. So, saving all beings, helping all beings, that's a little strong to say. Like, if hungry beings need food, I don't think we would go so far as to say that's not beneficial to them. It is. They need to be sustained in order to arouse bodhicitta. They need to eat, so we should feed them. But truly, the full extent of saving them is to help them to arouse this aspiration. Arousing such aspiration and the practice realization of it goes far beyond the boundary of practice and realization, delusion and enlightenment. It goes beyond the boundary of delusion and enlightenment. It's not anything, of course, that Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas can reach. Kashyapa Bodhisattva, or Mahakashyapa, praised the Buddha with a verse, although beginner's mind and ultimate mind are indistinguishable, the beginner's mind is more difficult. I bow to the beginner's mind that lets others awaken first. As soon as you arouse the aspiration for enlightenment, even if you transmigrate in the six realms and four forms of birth, transmigration itself will be your vow for enlightenment, or will be the conditions of your practice and vows for enlightenment. Although you may have wasted time so far, you should vow immediately before this present life ends, or it actually says, you should give rise to the vow. You should hotsugan. Gan is vow. Hotsu is give rise to or arouse the vow. So we chant in the mornings, right? Dogen's hotsugan verse, his arousing the vow verse. You should hotsugan immediately this. I vow with all sentient beings from this life on throughout countless lives to hear the true Dharma. That's the Eheikoso Hotsugan Man. In this translation, together with all sentient beings, may I hear the true Dharma from this birth throughout future births. When I hear the true Dharma, I will not doubt or distrust it. When I encounter the true Dharma, I will relinquish ordinary affairs and uphold the Buddha Dharma. So it's this what we call worldly affairs, we translate, is kind of nice in translation. It's actually, I will relinquish worldly dharmas and uphold Buddha Dharma. I will relinquish the world's Dharma and uphold Buddha Dharma. So it's kind of a little pair there that we lose when we say worldly affairs. I will renounce world Dharma and uphold Buddha Dharma. And uphold is actually receive and maintain, literally. I will let go of world dharmas and receive and maintain Buddha Dharma. Thus may I realize the way together with the great earth and all sentient beings. This vow is the ground, or the causes and conditions, or actually arousing this vow, this hotsugan, this arousing vow, is the cause and condition for genuine aspiration. Do not slacken in this determination.
This has a lot of overlap with the Eheikoso Hotsugan Man. Did that come first, or did this come first?
Yes, we talked about that, the first day.
Yeah.
The whole Eheikoso Hotsugan Man that we chant at the beginning of Dharma talks is lifted from this fascicle. Actually, the whole thing is in here, but it's kind of divided up. It's kind of like in here, it's in pieces woven in between other stuff. It looks like after Dogen was gone, that his followers said, how would we put Dogen's inspiring statement of how to arouse bodhicitta that we can use as a short chant? We don't want to chant this whole fascicle. So they took the vow and repentance kind of sections out of that and made it into the Eheikoso Hotsugan Man, which as I understand, Dogen didn't really write in that form himself as a vow. But here's the beginning. The Dogen vows. So, and that first paragraph, I think, is a really great little section you can memorize, and you can, when you sit down for zazen, and or you're resisting sashin, or you're resisting your life at any time, or you're feeling like everything's meaningless and this practice goes nowhere, and how do you get yourself into it in the first place? It's just a bunch of like painful stuff, and we could be, you know, walking on the beach. You can say to yourself, I vow from this life on throughout countless lives to hear the true Dharma, that upon hearing it, no doubt will arise in us, in me, and that upon meeting it, I won't lack in faith or trust, and upon meeting it, I'll let go of the world Dharma and receive and maintain the Buddha Dharma. And that in doing so, this is not just for us. If it's bodhicitta, in doing so may the great earth and all living beings together realize the Buddha way. So this is, there's three versions of bodhicitta. There's the me realize Buddha first, Buddhahood first, they talk about like the king version, right? You know, the king bodhicitta is like you first become the king and then you help your country's people from this kind of powerful position of having realized Buddhahood. Then the second version is like you all go together, like the ship captain, the ferryman, the ferry person, ferry driver. You're all crossing over to the other shore at the same time, kind of like this. And then there's the version of like the shepherd. You're just taking care of the sheep. They're more important than you. Actually, they go first. So there's you first, there's others first, and there's same time. Three versions of bodhicitta. And traditionally, they're not really like ranked better and worse. They're just three types. They're all legitimate bodhicitta. But in the Shobo Genzo, or Hotsu Bodaishin, it looks like Dogen says, promotes the others first version. And it looks like in this vow, he promotes the everyone together version. That in doing so, may we, together with all beings, realize the Buddha way. It's all okay. Yes.
So the Bodhisattva vow to help all other sentient beings reach the other shore before you still get to go.
Yeah, you get to go. You're the last one on the planet.
So it doesn't really matter.
It's a more patient way, right? It's like, I'm in no hurry. I do want to actually realize Buddhahood, but like, I can wait for everybody else to go first. Maybe a long time.
This is kind of resonating.
It includes termites and stuff too, right? Yeah.
This kind of makes sense when I think of mind only. In that, you know, if you encounter a Buddha or another, you know, it makes sense. And tying into the everyone has to go eventually, or else no one will go, right? Because if it's mind only, if you encounter something, then that's...
Yeah, and there's also the issue that if the Buddha says, amazing, all beings have this Buddha nature. The Buddha sees the Buddha nature in everyone, but they don't see it. Thomas Cleary's footnote on this topic says it's like a one-way mirror. Like, you know, your room, like maybe prisons or something have those one-way mirrors, right? So sentient beings are looking at the mirror side. They just see themselves. But the Buddhas are on the other side, and they see all these beings like as Buddhas. But actually, there's not like a fixed way that they really are Buddha nature, but they, it's blocked by this mirror that just keeps reflecting themselves back. So yeah, how come if the Buddha realized that we are all him, then how, or her, how can we, how come we're not fully manifested Buddhas? In the first chapter of the Transmission of Light on Shakyamuni Buddha, it says something like, all of us now reside in the eyeball of Shakyamuni Buddha.
that mirror comes up very often.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember where, but looking at during meditation, comparing it to a mirror,
mm-hmm.
you see your Bono. I don't really understand that. Isn't it more like a microscope?
Isn't what more like a microscope? Meditation?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's two. I think in there's like two different ways of using the mirror metaphor. You know, in that way, in the one-way mirror thing, it's like they just see themselves, and that's delusion. But maybe it's not so different after all, though, because we could say we talk about mirror awareness, mirror mind of meditation, where it's like, you know. If we're looking at the outside the one-way mirror and we're seeing our own reflection, we're like the sentient being stuck here. But meditation is like becoming the mirror. And that it's just a nice image, I think a really great image for meditation, that the mirror just reflects whatever's put before it. It has no preferences. It just receives the image and it doesn't distort it. If it's a really clear, that's why we have these metaphors like polishing the mirror, so it reflects it really clearly without distorting it. Because if there's dust on the mirror, you're going to get a distorted image. And all those stories that come up around, do you have to polish it, or is there really no mirror at all? But just to take the basic mirror metaphor, I think it's a really great image. That's another thing, if you forget what Zazen is and what am I supposed to be doing, just be a mirror right now and just reflect whatever comes. Okay, there's pain in my butt, but I'm not the pain in the butt, and I'm not the one thinking about the pain in the butt. I'm just the mirror mind, the awareness that's just receiving the image of butt pain and not altering it in any way, and just like a mirror, not preferring non-butt pain over butt pain. Mirrors are so great this way, right? They just like, they don't care who's looking in it. They're just reflect. May all beings reflect the apparent world like a vast, great, perfect mirror, without preferring this or that, and compassionately, openly receiving all. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.